Hey to all you fish enthusiasts out there. Whether you're an avid angler or just curious about fish, we'd like to welcome you to Fish of the Week, your audio almanac of all the fish. It's Monday, October 23rd, 2023, and we're on a week-by-week tour of fish across the country with guests from all walks of life. I'm Katrina Liebeck with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Alaska.
And I'm Guy Yero, and this week we're going to be talking about a snaggletooth serpent of the seas. We're talking about the wolf eel.
They are lovely. And we are very happy to have two guests today, Andres Lopez, who's a curator of fishes and associate professor of fisheries at the University of Alaska Museum in Fairbanks, and Kelsey Barker, who's an aquarist at the Monterey Bay Aquarium in California. So thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Okay, so this is a really neat fish. It has a really unique look. And I'm wondering from both of you, what's the first thing that impressed you when you first saw this fish? And could you both just help us get a feel for what the fish looks like?
The first time I ever saw a wolf eel was diving in Puget Sound. You've got your underwater flashlight and you're looking at a big rocky pile reef. And all of a sudden a fish face comes out at you. They've got these craggly faces. Some people describe them as like old man faces or grandpa faces. It was a really cool first experience that kind of started my love for these fish.
My experience is not as direct, so it's mostly from my days as a grad student in Seattle and going to the aquarium and seeing them in captivity. So that was the first time I actually saw a live eel. And around the same time, the Rogue Brewery in Oregon had a beer whose label was a wolf eel. So at that age, that made a especially strong impression on me. Because they had on the label, there's the face of that wolf eel. And I always remember that.
And how big are these fish? What else about that face? If you had the fish like in your hand or you're underwater looking at them, what are some of the other characteristics?
From my perspective, it doesn't look like a fish, right? It has almost like the face of a lizard or an iguana maybe. Plus it has those canine teeth at the front that are very prominent. I think as Kelsey said, the most striking thing about a wolf eel is just the snout and the face. But then when it starts swimming, you realize it's a really long eel-like thing. In preparing for our conversation, I came across some accounts where folks many years ago used to think of large wolf eels as juvenile snake some kind of sea monster.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things you also see next to the wolf eel's face are those pectoral fins on the side. So a common misconception with these guys is people thinking that they're eels because they're long and skinny and 6, 7, 8 feet long, and they kind of move like eels do.
So that actually gets into my question, because I was reading that, and you know, I used to work down at the aquarium in Newport, and that's like the first thing we always tell people: it's not actually an eel. But you know, we've talked about American eels on this show, and they have pectoral fins. Conger eels, they're true anguilliform fishes; they have pectoral fins, and so I've never thought that's a great characteristic. What's the difference between the wolf eel, the true eels, and then also the wolf fish, which is also kind of different out in the Atlantic?
I can give you the extra boring ichthyologist answer to the wolf eel question.
Yes, so please
eels, give it to us.
The true eels or any true group of fish in the world of systematic biology comes from recent ancestry. So the only criterion that we care about is that we have some line of evidence that tells us that all of these different species descend from a common ancestor that they don't share with any other living species. So the anguilliforms are all the descendants living and extinct of a hypothetical common ancestor to the anguillid lineages or the anguilliform lineages. And anything that did not descend from that hypothetical ancestor is not a true eel. It may be eel-shaped. It may have evolved into having that elongate snake-like body, but it's not a true eel. It may carry the common name something eel, like the wolf eel, but we don't recognize it as being a true eel, which brings up all these conflicting ideas of how we use language, right? Like anguilliforms has a very specific technical meaning, but eel doesn't have to carry that. It's a convenient way of referring to something that has a particular shape.
Okay.
So that's where the distinction comes, and the eel term comes up in so many fish groups. Whenever you talk about eels, people want to talk about electric eels, right? And mm-hmm. electric eels are not eels. There are so many eels that are not eels. There's a lot of eels that are true eels, about 800 species.
That's a great point. What is the closest relative to this fish?
There's multiple species of wolffish. They're in a different genus from the wolf eel genus and Arictes, but together they belong to a larger group that includes things like the eel pouts,
okay,
also not a very common fish, the pricklebacks, also okay, not a very common fish, the gunnels, maybe a little more familiar to folks that do tide pooling. Whenever you're pulling rocks and looking for little fish under rocks, there's usually gunnels there. And all of those things that I've mentioned are eel-shaped. They're elongate. They look like eels. And many of them have eel in their common name, but they're not obviously members of the anguilliforms.
That wasn't boring at all. Thank you.
Fish evolve certain forms based on the habitats they're living in and the selective pressure for them. So these eel-looking fishes, what habitats are they living in, and how does this eel-like shape help them, you know, dominate in those habitats?
Yeah, so a lot of times they're going to be living in rocky reefs, rock piles, pilings, anything like that. So if you're looking at them in the wild, and even in captivity for the most part, you're just going to see that head. And the rest of their body is going to be curled up or within the rocks. And that's really going to protect them from predators. Wolf eels, when they get larger, they don't have a ton of natural predators, but there still are some bigger fish that go after them, some bigger sharks. And actually, harbor seals tend to go after them too. So if you can protect most of your body by being inside a bunch of rocks, that's really going to be beneficial for you.
It's called their den, right?
Yes, their den. And a lot of times they have their home den, and that is their own den. And if somebody tries to get them out, it's not good. It's
not good. So I have a question just related to the name wolf eel. They have a den. They have those like canine teeth. Are there other reasons why it's called wolf, or is it mostly like appearance, behavior, or a combination thereof?
Scientific names first came in from the Atlantic side. So the original member of the family is the Atlantic wolffish. The scientific name that goes back all the way to the very early days of binomial nomenclature has Anoricus as the genus name, but then the species name is Lupus, L-U-P-U-S, which is wolf in Latin. So maybe this wolf association comes from way, way before then, before wolf eels took on the name wolf eel. So I don't know the order of business, but Atlantic wolffish were wolffish and were in the scientific literature way, way, way before the wolf eels.
Where are these fish found on the map? I know we've talked a little bit about where they're found in the water and what habitats they like. What's their range?
They actually have a pretty wide range. These guys are staying in the Pacific, but on the U.S. coast, they can go down to Baja California, then all the way up to Alaska, Russia, Japan. And I think about the Sea of Japan is usually their southernmost range on that side of the Pacific, whereas the other wolf fish are usually up in the Arctic or over at the Atlantic side.
So I'm used to seeing wolf eels that are this kind of concrete gray color, which is stunning and beautiful. But when I was doing some research before this episode, I was seeing some of the juveniles and they're like a brick orange, like a terracotta almost. And it blew me away. I didn't know that they were that color. So is there a reason why they go through that color change?
Well, if you look at their life cycle, larval fish and larval wolf eels, when they're born, they're pelagic for about up to the first 2 years of their life.
Oh, wow.
So a lot of times, if you're that orange color, you're going to kind of disappear in the pelagic zones. And then as they get older and larger and bigger and start to settle into the rocks, they're going to start adapting more of those rock-like colors. So you'll see some that are sometimes darker gray, sometimes with a purplish hue. Generally, males tend to get lighter and grayer, and then the females tend to stay a little darker and sometimes more purpley. You'll also see differences in males and females, but not until they get old enough usually to make their den and start laying eggs, about 7 years. And you'll see the males get like this big extra bulbous head, and they kind of get a little more grandpa. And then the females tend to be a little more svelte, like with a more sloped rostrum. But sometimes if you see them like separately in the wild, it's hard to tell which is which. But when they're in a den together, you can usually tell the males from the females at that point.
Oh, are these guys monogamous or do they always have the same mate?
Sometimes in nature, you could put quotation marks around the monogamous. Mm-hmm. There definitely are mated pairs in the wild. I'm a pretty heavy scuba diver and I dove in Puget Sound. So I got really used to some of those common dive sites. And sometimes you would see what people would assume are the same mated pair in the same den year after year. You get a lot of reports about that. However, that's not guaranteeing that every single wolf eel is like that. A lot of times they'll at least be monogamous through the mating season. And what's really cool is that they'll lay eggs in the den, and then both the male and the female take turns of taking care of the eggs. So one will go out, go eat, go do their thing, come back, and then they'll actually switch so that there's one of them always in the den. So they're monogamous usually at least through the mating season. However, year after year, it is not a guarantee. If a bigger, beefier wolf eel comes along, normally a female is going to go for something a little different.
Okay.
In captivity, have you observed the kind of the mating behavior, the courtship rituals?
What's really funny is previously we had what we assumed was a mated pair in a smaller exhibit because we didn't see any courtship. They never laid eggs, but they definitely acted like it together. They kind of shared the same den together. But when we introduced both of them together to our larger exhibit with a larger male wolf eel, the female left the previous male for the new male. They could be seen in the new male's den, and then the old male had a den behind the rockwork. Honestly, it kind of was like a soap opera between these two, because sometimes the smaller male would come out and try to like swim around the female, and if the older male wasn't there, she might go back to the other den with him.
Oh, man.
But then if the older male was there, she wasn't leaving his side.
Drama.
It was the soap opera of the kelp forest tank.
But no fights between the males?
Like, no real fights. They'll posture. I never saw any real fights in that scenario.
How dangerous is that mouth?
If you're a crab, very dangerous. They eat a lot of invertebrates because they have very strong jaws. So they'll eat fish, but they also can go after urchins, sand dollars, crabs, all of that. So if they wanted to take a bite out of a diver, they could do some damage. Usually they're not going to be a big threat to them. Unless they get more protective if they've laid an egg clutch. And sometimes divers in the wild will get too aggressive trying to get their hands into the den, trying to get pictures. And that's not going to end up good for the diver. I've known them to rip through dry suits. And so that's kind of the fault of the diver, though.
I'm curious. You guys have a great aquarium, by the way. I need to get back one of these days. But for the fish in your exhibits, how do you come into those? How do you get new wolf eels to, say, put on exhibit?
Most of our wolf eels are actually captive bred. We've got some right now from Aquarium of the Bay up in San Francisco. We have some that are several years old from Oregon Coast Aquarium. We do have permits to collect them from the wild, but we haven't had to for a while because there's been enough captive bred ones that have been available for us.
How do you raise them then? You say they have this 2-year pelagic stage. How do you simulate that in captivity?
You basically set up an exhibit to pretty much mimic that pelagic state. So that might include the way the water comes in, any pumps going on, just to keep them up in the water column. And then you add in the food that they would eat in the water column. So a lot of times copepods, Artemia brine shrimp, rotifers, and as they get bigger, you start upping the type of food that you'll give them. And then you also start to give them options to settle out in the exhibit, normally behind the scenes. And then as they get bigger, you match the food that they would eat in the wild.
If you had a bunch of kids at your aquarium looking at this fish, what are some facts that you'd like to throw out to them?
At Monterey Bay Aquarium, one of the missions is to further education. And actually, school groups get into the aquarium for free. And we also have different programs, both within the aquarium and in an offsite education facility for teachers and for students. Our ultimate goal is to inspire conservation of the ocean. And that's what we focus really hard on trying to do. One of the things that I like talking about wolf eels that you get in captivity is some of them actually elicit touch. They like being scratched. They liked interacting with divers. When feeding shows come out, they'll come out of their dens. They'll wrap around the feeding show divers. I was talking earlier about the male-female pair. there's also a difference just between those two fish personality-wise. The male liked touch. The male would come out and put its chin like it was looking up towards the surface, just kind of like a dog, you know, extending like, ooh, scratch right here, scratch right here. And so that one would like scratches and touch, whereas the female just wanted you to give her food and then go back to her den just because that's what she preferred. Yeah, a lot of times people think fish in general are, they all act the same, and wolf eels are definitely one that you can see different personalities for, even when they're younger.
What does it feel like when you scratch their chin like a dog?
Well, I've got gloves on underwater because it's cold, but it feels kind of like solid jello, like jello that's been sitting in the fridge for too long and it solidifies.
Okay.
They're very smooth too. If you scratch them, they'll then swim through your hands and you can scratch down. You can feel their fin underneath, which is very loose, and you can scratch down their whole body and then they'll come back and do it again.
Wow.
Cool.
Andres, what does your museum have and what does it mean to be curator of fishes?
Yeah, so it's a disappointing answer because usually people think that there's a lot of living fish in our behind the scenes, but unlike an aquarium, all our fish have long been dead. One way in which I describe the job of a curator of a natural history research collection is we're librarians in a sense. Mm-hmm. Our shelves are stacked with specimens. And each one of those specimens or sets of specimens gives us some insight on some population of animals that were out there in the landscape at some point, right? So we have, as curator of the fish collection, I develop and help run a library of fish specimens focused on species that occur in Alaska. And on our shelves, we have jars and jars of preserved fishes that have been collected over the past 6 or 7 decades. Each one is associated with all we know about who collected it, where they were collected, how they were collected, and our best effort at identifying that particular specimen. So whenever you see a map with a whole bunch of dots of a given species on the landscape, the great majority come from some kind of research collection that has documented the occurrence of a species in a place.
I assume you have a wolf eel on your shelf?
We have some wolf eels, yeah. We also have a Bering wolf fish that showed up in Barrow some years ago. So,
how big a jar for the wolf fish, for the wolf eel?
So for really large specimens, we have stainless steel tanks that are about 4x4 in perimeter and then about maybe 4 feet deep. And that's where we keep the really large specimens. Our museum is regional in focus. So we're looking at Alaska species. But if you go to a place like the California Academy of Sciences or the National Museum at the Smithsonian, they have stainless steel tanks that can hold a large shark. So our large specimen holdings are not as impressive as some of the larger museums.
Can people visit the museum or can scientists come and study the fish that you have curated there?
That's a great question. So the museum has a public facing site. So we have exhibits that draw from the work that we do here in the research collections. But the research collections themselves are of limit to the public, but open to students and researchers. Most importantly, this research collection and most research collections also run a very lively lending program, an interlibrary loan. So if there's a group of people interested in the geographic variation that wolf eels show across the range, they will scan databases of research collections and learn whether or not the specimens are available to be loaned out. And that means wrapping them in cheesecloth and putting them in the mail and sending them all over the world for more work. Lately, folks are using those collections for things beyond systematics, beyond species descriptions or geography, because what we now realize is that if a group of specimens were collected in 1950 from outside of Juneau, not only do you have a record of that species and what it looked like and its anatomy and things like that, you also have a biosampler. Everything that happened to that fish when it was alive back then in the 1950s is recorded in its body. So you can take a piece of tissue and learn about parasites or diseases that were prevalent at the time. you can use it to learn a little bit about the ecology of that species at that time, because you can take measurements of stable isotopes and all these other chemical composition methods that we have to learn things. You can learn a little bit about genetic variation and how it's shifted over the course of however long you can sample through research collections.
I know when you preserve a specimen in formalin and then ethanol, it can sometimes be pretty challenging to get a good extraction of DNA that can be readable from that. So considering how important genetics is now, when you're preserving these fish, are you doing anything to, like, say, preserve a fin clip and RNA later or something like that, so that people further down the line could get better genetic data or expression data from these samples?
Absolutely. That has changed pretty dramatically over the course of my career as a fish person. I got my grad degrees in the late 90s when genetics was becoming more and more and more common and important. So at that time, when I started collecting fishes for fish collections, we began the regular practice of taking a little fin clip and putting that in some sort of storage, like you mentioned, that would preserve the genetic information, and then using the rest of the specimen for the standard formalin fixation ethanol preservation route. So now it's common practice. If folks that are out there collecting specimens or doing biodiversity surveys commonly have a fork in the road of preservation where some portion of that specimen ends up in some kind of storage that allows for genetic use, and then the other preserves the anatomy as well as we can. But if you go back to the 80s and 70s, that was not common practice. Back then, the whole specimen went in the same direction. So it's a little more challenging to get genetic information from those older specimens.
Interesting. Seems like both of these types of institutions, the museum with kind of the deceased collection and the aquarium, both serve a very important role. Why should people care about this fish?
Because they're the best.
We care about all the fish.
Because they're
all
adorable.
Fish are incredible.
Because they're fun. They're unique. They're distinct. And caring more about this fish can lead to caring more about the environment in general, the ocean in general. And it's obviously something that needs a lot of people to care about, to really take care of.
In addition, one of the cool, top thing, interesting things about wolf eels is parental care. Parental mm-hmm. care is not super common in fishes. It does happen. And having biparental care, the couple taking care of the developing eggs, is interesting. And they belong to a larger group where there's a lot of interesting reproductive biology and caring and protecting the developing clutch. So from an evolutionary biology perspective, it's probably a group that would yield lots of really interesting insights on the principles behind a group that is not known for parental care, evolving complex forms of parental care. Something's going on among the eel pouts and the gunnels and the wolf eels. We're investing and sacrificing some of your time and resources to making sure that clutch makes its way all the way into hatching.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Awesome.
It's a utilitarian, let's say, but I think we should all care for these unique, different forms.
You can learn a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in Washington State, and some of the Native American tribes actually ate this fish as well. I know about the macaw. They called them doctor fish. And actually, only the medicine man in the tribe were the only ones allowed to eat the doctor fish. So it's also really interesting to see how different populations of people treated these fish throughout time and still do.
Okay.
In preparing for the conversation, I realized that there is not a ton of work having been done or being done on wolf fish or wolf eel biology. The little bit there is seems to be driven by this idea that maybe aquaculture will be the way of the future. I'm interested in genetic diversity and genetic variability, so I immediately went looking for how much do we know about genetic diversity in wolf eels. It turns out we don't know very much at all. You guys may be familiar with the concept of barcoding as a way of identifying species. So researchers across different fields have decided that there's one little gene segment that we're all going to sequence from every animal or plant that we can get our hands on. And we'll use that as a barcode to identify species. So these barcode sequence libraries are growing like crazy. For wolf eels, you find out that not very many specimens of wolf eels have been barcoded. And given that they have such an extensive range going all the way from Mexico into the Aleutian Islands, we know almost nothing about whether that is one great big continuous population or if we're actually dealing with a whole bunch of different segments that are somehow isolated from each other, distinct from each other in some interesting way. We just know that they're there, but we don't know anything about variation within the species and whether that variation is related to some geographic barrier that keeps them from moving around. We know they're somewhat sedentary, but maybe the larval phase and the pelagic phase is also constraining how much it moves around. We don't have access to that information right now.
Need some grad students to jump on that one.
And lots of specimens.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny. Sometimes the more you learn about a fish in particular or anything in particular in science, the more you know you don't know and the more research that needs to be done. There's always more work to be done and more things to be discovered.
Well, thank you both so much. Great information. Really appreciate you two coming on and sharing your knowledge with us. This was great.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, this has been really cool. I appreciate it. I've always loved working with these since my first internship. I was able to work with baby wolf eels too and fell in love and seeing them in the wild. So I've always had a soft spot in my heart for them.
Okay, so we're going to shift gears and have diver and marine biologist Scuba Max call in and help us get a feel for what it's like to be underwater with a wolf eel in its natural habitat. So welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so are you ready to take us on a dive to go see these fish?
Absolutely.
First things first, what kind of gear? We need ice and we need to have some warmth around us for diving with these guys.
So if you're trying to find a wolf eel, you're most likely diving in pretty cold waters. Some people do it with a thick wetsuit, but most people use a dry suit. Some of the larger wolf eels are pretty deep, so you do need your advanced open water certification to go deep to find those big wolf eels. You need a scuba tank. You need a dive computer, you need a BCD, a buoyancy control device, vest, your regulators, you need a mask, you know, a knife maybe in case you get entangled. You need your fins, obviously, you need dry gloves. When we're diving, you know, we're diving in the winter in Canada, so the water's pretty cold. Air temperature sometimes can be cold. So yeah, we definitely want to stay warm and as dry as possible. So it's a pretty extreme sport.
Awesome.
That sounds like a lot of gear, a lot of work, cold temperatures. I'm not even a big fan of going out and going skiing because I get cold. So it seems like there must be a pretty big payoff at the end of this. What drives you to go down and keep looking for these fish?
Yeah, it can be an unpleasant sport in terms of cold, especially in the winter when there's a bit of snow on the shore and you enter these frigid waters. But it's so incredible. You know, you get to spend an hour underwater. Very few people in the world actually get to see this. You know, there are lots of tropical divers, and even then, still a fraction of the population that get to scuba dive in the tropics, but it's even a smaller population that gets to scuba dive in cold waters. And the amount of life that we see underwater is so beautiful. You know, obviously, today we're talking about wolf eels, but we also get to see, you know, giant Pacific octopus that are as big as a human, right? And they interact with us. And you know, we get to see squid and we get to see, you know, massive lingcod and really cool crabs. We have some of the most diverse nudibranchs on the planet. You can do a dive and see a dozen different species of nudibranchs, which are colorful marine slugs, right?
Yeah, so beautiful.
Those are really fun. And there's always something new. Every dive, you see something different. You try to ID what you find. You know, I like to take videos. Sometimes the animals interact with you. We get stellar sea lions that come, you know, and do backflips in front of us. And yeah, most people think that, oh, you know, we have dark black water and there must be nothing down there, but it's actually very colorful. We have corals, we have sponges, purples, greens, pinks, oranges, all the colors down there.
Okay, so we've got our gear on. We're ready for the cold, ready to go see this beautiful place. How do we actually go about finding one of these fish? And are there any in particular that you go see, like actual individual fish that you know?
They're pretty elusive. They're hard to find. Some of them will stay to their den. So if you know of a specific spot, for example, there's one famous wolf eel that's on Vancouver Island that the locals know of. We have divers that have been diving with this wolf eel specifically for over 25 years. So This one gentleman in particular, we call him Grandpa, and he's always in the same den, the same spot. Pretty hard to access and quite deep. So you do need a pretty good level of training to actually go see him. But, you know, for the newer divers out there, you can definitely see wolf eels at many sites, whether you're accessing by shore or, you know, by dive boat. You can see juveniles, you know, more in the shallows, and those are really fun too. You just kind of need to know where to look, and you just need to be patient and spend a lot of time in the water, and you might get to see one.
So you mentioned a den. Are these fish hanging out in, like, I guess, one spot, or what is a den exactly? What is it made out of, and how are they interacting with it?
Yeah, so wolf eels are pretty shy animals. So the adults will find like the best crack and kind of live in there, and that'll be their home for many years, right? And the juveniles often they'll still be in holes or cracks, but kind of smaller in the sand, or they go out to hunt, but most of the time they are in their den and they don't really come out. So usually you just kind of see their ugly face kind of hidden in those crevices. And then when they do come out of their den, it's almost like they're undulating. Yeah, it's hard to explain. Almost like a snake, you know, and then they just kind of crawl back into their den. And yeah, they're really neat creatures. They are known to be really interactive with divers. They'll grab some sea urchins along the bottom floor. They'll, you know, offer it to the wolf eels. And that's how you kind of create a bond with them. That entices them to come out of their den. And that's when you really get to see how long and beautiful they actually are. I personally don't like to physically interact with any wild animals. They are wild animals. They have very strong jaws. You wouldn't want to get your finger stuck there. No. I'm always prudent. So I do have one friend in particular who's been diving with Grandpa for, you know, 25 years. And this individual actually recognizes my friend. So without any food, the wolf eel will come out and greet him and, you know, swim around him and all that. But generally, you know, like Grandpa doesn't really care for me, unfortunately. We haven't developed that bond yet.
Yeah. Do you have any tips for divers in terms of respecting the fish? I know you've mentioned a few ideas already, or just any other kind of safety considerations for the fish or for divers?
I guess it boils down to, you know, personal choice and values. Some people are really against feeding wild animals. Some people think, hey, it's just nature and it's cool and there isn't much harm to it. So my personal opinion, it's to each their own, right? Our sea urchins in our area are definitely not endangered. But I mean, with that said, it's not great to habituate animals to people, because we are starting to get a lot of spear fishers on our coast. So people that free dive and, you know, target some of these animals. So that's one of the dangers, right? If you get octopus or wolf eels used to people, then they'll come out and could be a meal for some of those spear fishers. So that is the downside to it.
Yeah. Okay. All good advice.
You know, I think there's also a positive side where, you know, if people like myself film these animals and then parents tell me that kids watch my videos and they get inspired and they want to become marine biologists, or they want to get into scuba diving and, you know, they want to protect the ocean. So, you know,
that's cool.
So when you're making your videos, you're talking about these fish being down deep. And so you're probably having to bring just some lights with you just to see. But I'm curious how you go about getting good images on a camera down that deep.
Yeah, lights are definitely key. I just use a simple GoPro because, you know what, honestly, the quality is pretty good for what it is. I have a case on it so it doesn't crack under pressure. It's mounted, you know, on a mount with big arms with the big lights. So the lights is really what's important here. Our waters are very dark. You know, you lose sunlight pretty quick as you start descending. And we also do lots of night dives. That's actually my favorite to do, is the night dives in the wintertime. So yeah, we need those strong lights to get those colors out.
Doing the night dives at the wintertime, you can do them at like 6 o'clock. You'd be home for dinner. That's kind of nice.
Exactly.
Up where you are.
Exactly. You know, 6 o'clock, you can be in the water, spend an hour and a half down there exploring, and then, you know, be home at a reasonable time. And yeah.
Are you diving in the summertime at all too? Or are these guys more active certain times of year or certain times of day?
No. Wolf fields, you can see them during the day, at night, summer, winter, anytime. Yeah.
Awesome.
Why do you think that they're so charismatic among all the cool fish out there and all the cool nudibranchs? You're talking about the sea slugs and you got the lingcod and you got the cabazon. Why do people really love this fish in particular? Why is it had such personality?
Maybe it's because they are really long lived and they seem to have thoughts, right? Like they seem like they're thinking about something, you know, like some fish just swim around and, you know, all animals are smart and important in their own ways, but wolf eels seem a little bit, you know, more. They seem like they're thinking, like out of our divers, they have favorites, they build bonds with certain people and kind of change their behavior. They are highly intelligent, they build mated pairs. Yeah, and then I think it's also just the way they look, right? Like they just, it's like only a mother could love, you know, it's it just looks like an old man with, I don't know. It's like
the big
there's nothing.
And,
this, yeah, like nothing on this planet looks like these fish, right? Like they just they look creepy but cute. They got their big lips, big eyes, and their big head, and they're just so awkward. And some of their gums got injured, so they're missing parts of their gums or their lips. And they got their teeth are always kind of crooked and pointing in different directions. So they're just interesting looking fish. And, you know, when you look at them, you can tell that they're looking into your eyes and there's some type of connection there.
They look like they'd be kind of squishy, their face. I can just imagine what it would feel like.
They're cute.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Max.
Thanks, Max.
Awesome talking with you. And yeah, really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. I'm glad I could share some fun stories here.
Okay. We'll get out there and enjoy all the fish, especially the wolf eel. Thanks for listening to Fish of the Week. My name is Katrina Liebeck, and my co-host is Guy Iro. Our production partner for the series is Citizen Race Car. Produced and story edited by Tasha A.F. Lemley. Production management by Gabriella Montekin. Post-production by Alex Brower. Fish of the Week is a production of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska Regional Office of External Affairs. We honor, thank, and celebrate the whole community, individual tribes, states, our sister agencies, fish enthusiasts, scientists, and others who have elevated our understanding and love as people and professionals of all the fish. I'm Katrina Liebeck with the U.S. Fish... I messed up my own agency name!